Transmission start. Welcome to Where Did the Road Go? Join us as we wander off the path and explore lost history, consciousness, the paranormal, unexplained mysteries, alternative thought, and much more. We are present on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com. Now here is your host, Soraya.
Greetings and welcome to Where Did the Road Go? Tonight is another two-part interview. This is part one tonight, part two next week, and patrons will get it right away, so you get the whole, both parts here at the beginning of the week. And as well, I have a fairly lengthy patrons-only segment here. And our guest tonight will be Steph Young, talking about not her newest book, because we're a little bit behind having her on. We're going to be talking about Nightmares in the Woods, at least two books back at this point. In other things, a bunch of you have submitted stories for a listener's stories show. I'm actually, I am working on something for that, and don't think I've forgotten about you, because I haven't. If you have a story that you'd like to tell on the air or have us read on the air, you can contact us through the website, wheredidtheroadgo.com. And instead of doing a full show, we may start doing maybe a couple a week or something like that. If you want to become a patron and help out the show, again, go to the website. And it's only $3 a month. You get some extra content whenever possible. You will get full interviews like tonight's, where it's two parts. You're going to get both parts right away. You're not going to have to wait a week to hear the second part. I'm also working on some cool giveaways. Also on the website, check out our forum. You can like us on Facebook. We have a group on Facebook as well. Basically, get in touch with us. Talk to us. We like to talk to you. And I want to thank everyone who has supported this show, whether you be a patron or a loyal listener or have just spread the word of the show. This show has so far exceeded any expectations I ever had for it. And I couldn't be happier about it. And I am obviously going to try and continue to give you the best possible show I can every week. Upcoming, we do have Artie Six Killer Clark coming back, and I'm working on a couple big guests who have never been on the show before. Hopefully that's going to happen before the end of the year, and some other special stuff, bringing some people together who may not have had conversations before. A bunch of roundtables coming up with some interesting people. It's going to be a lot of fun. All right, so without any further ado, Here's part one, anyway, of my conversation with Steph Young. All right, Steph, welcome back to the show.
Hello, Soraya. Thank you for having me.
And we're going to talk about a book that's now three books old, I believe, because you write quicker than Nick Redfern at this point.
I do, don't I? I do 16 hours a day, so yeah, I do a lot of research.
And it's been a bit since I've had you on, so we're going to be talking about Nightmares in the Woods.
Yes.
And there are some really creepy stories in this one. So I guess we can start off with the Whispering People. Now, this is a Malaysian legend. And,
yeah.
And you had some recent cases that kind of connect to it.
Yeah, I didn't really know about these, but apparently in Malaysia, there's the Orang Bunian, who are said to kidnap people. And the Malaysian Star had written about this in July 2015. And they said that this man was a runner who disappeared on a popular trail in the Bukit Hatamas area, which is in Cheras in Malaysia. Well, it was 8 days into the search for him when a volunteer posted an update on Facebook, and the man called Clash had written, strong evidence, he is still alive. We found fresh blood stains, vomit, and footsteps deep in the woods. So these are positive signs. Well, he was a runner for the Harriers local running group, who met weekly in that forest to go running and orienting. And the fire and rescue department had gone in there on the search, and the civil defence department. But 10 days into the search, they'd called it off because they couldn't find any other signs. And his car was in the car park, and his cell phone was there in his wallet. But they had to stop, really, because they couldn't find anything. They consulted with some Buddhist monks for help, and all of them said you'll find him northwest of the foot of the hill, but actually there still wasn't any sign of him. Well, all the local people said the Urung Bunyan had taken him, or the whistling people, and they said that they'd whisked him away to another world that the searchers just couldn't see. Well, this hit the leader of the Harriers running group quite hard, because he had actually remembered the time that it happened to him. Or rather, the time that he couldn't remember, because Hardeep Singh, who was 53 and a paralegal, he'd had the same sort of experience on his own, which to this day remains a complete blank for him. And it had happened in the same woods. And he said, I remember making my way there. It was May 2012. And I was going to lay the trail for the run scheduled that weekend. And then I can remember my wife embracing me as I lay on a stretcher, having been brought down from the hilltop. But nothing comes to mind between that moment and when I arrived at the woods, or how I came to be without clothes. He said, what transpired between that moment that I stepped into the forest until I regained consciousness is just a blank void, despite 3 years having passed. And the police, he said, were involved in looking for me. And when they found me, they said that, you know, they couldn't understand what was wrong with him, and he can't remember anything about it either. And he says, well, people have come up with theories, and one being is that I offended the keepers of the forest. But the question is, of course, how did I end up naked and survive without food or water, given that it's quite hot there? And he said all these questions remain just completely unanswered. Well, the consensus of the opinion of the local people is that he met with these whistling people, and they're called the forest spirits, and they're said to enchant and lead the forest visitors astray. And you can't see them, but they can see you. And they're also called the magical residents of the wood, and they're supposed to be grouped under the jinn. And it said that if you hear them shouting or singing or babbling in the woods when you approach the source, you won't be able to even see their shadow. But they're said to be responsible for making people get lost and, you know, abducting people. And they're blamed for the sort of disappearances of hikers and children. And their magic is linked to their ability, obviously, to make themselves invisible, because Bunyan comes from the word sound. So in other words, you can only hear them, but you'll never see them. So there's lots of stories, actually. There's another one about a 15-year-old boy, and again it was in the newspapers, and he was called Mod Ghani, and he vanished for 8 days in 2008 in, again, another forested region, and it's about 1,000 feet upwards from sea level. Well, the newspaper there reported, and it said that Mud was found today in a place that had been repeatedly searched by the search party, and it triggered a confounding mystery, because even the boy himself wonders how the search team and the volunteers and even his mother did not see him when he was in that same place all the time he was missing. And the boy said, well, during the search period for all of those 8 days, the search parties and the people that were looking for me, they came across me, and I heard my mother call, but I couldn't do anything. So I could see her, I was calling to her, but I couldn't get her to see me. And he says, I never left the area in which I was supposed to have disappeared. And the state chief police, Mr. Hussein, said, well, this is completely astonishing, because the boy was found 8 metres from the bridge that he'd last been seen standing on. And he said, I was quite surprised that after all of the places we were looking for him, behold, he's there at the centre of where he disappeared. And the funny thing is, he said, he's in, you know, great health. He's not hungry or tired or thirsty. And there was 130 people looking for him. And there he is, standing there, just wearing a towel and gazing out over the water. So again, he'd lost his clothes and he had a towel around him. And the boy was a scout himself. And again, he said he's no idea why they couldn't see him. You know, it's very strange. But there's lots of incidences like that, and one was really odd. It was a lady called Sama Yusuf, and she was a really experienced hiker, and she said it began when she went to pick a strange flower as she was nearing the end of her hike. And she said, I fell into something really strange immediately that came over me. I didn't want to leave, but I felt really, really sad, and I could hear this voice close to my ear. And I felt tempted to follow the voice, from behind the hill. It was luring me and it was inviting me to follow it, but then I just started crying and I didn't want to hear that voice anymore, and it felt as though I was entering a different world. Well, she'd been with a party of hikers at the time, and the leader of the group, Kay Gennison, I think was the name, said that he remembered seeing her suddenly and inexplicably descending the steep hill by the abseiling route, going really fast. He said, we heard this lady screaming and crying, and we ran forward and we saw it was this same lady that had roped down really fast. And we found her sitting at the base of a tree with both of her hands clutching her ears, and her head was down and she was just shaking uncontrollably. And he said, we tried to calm her down and we tried to get her to walk with us, but she was afraid. And she said that something was following us, but we couldn't see what it was. And as we led her out of the woods, her fear changed to hysterical laughter. He said, so in my opinion, she'd become possessed by something. Well, she says that her strange experience didn't end there, because when she went to bed that night, she said, I could still hear the screaming voice in my head. There's a journalist, anyway, who lives in that region, and he's been hiking and mountaineering for about 25 years. And he said, well, you may call this superstition, you know, that the spirits of the forest exist and they're guardian spirits and it's taboo to say anything that's disrespectful and we're trespassing. He said, but I went through the same experience myself. I was in the Cameroon Highlands and I was under the spell of these spirits. He said, it was during my climb, and as I was descending alone, I found myself going round and round in circles. I couldn't see any other path to get out by. He said, I had no sense of time and my mind was just blank. There was silence and calm until two other members arrived, and they were on a 5-day trek. And these two other members said to me, what was I doing? And I told them, come in, come and join me. And they knew something was terribly wrong, because my face was completely white and my behaviour was very strange and my body language was totally out of the norm. And they said that later his voice had been really forceful and they'd had to physically drag him out of the circle. And actually, that reminded me of the man that wrote to me on the San Juan Islands near Vancouver, and he had a similar kind of experience. Anyway, so he said none of us spoke for hours after that as we continued our descent. And then at the base, they told me what had happened. And he said, I know that I escaped the clutches of these spirits. He said there were other times that similar things have happened. He said, you know, one member said that she was convinced that something was following behind her and she could hear the footsteps and she started to run. But of course, we couldn't see anything at all behind us. There's some really strange stories, but one in particular actually is a doctor called Ong Hian Tat, I believe. He's a paranormal investigator, and he was telling the story of what he calls the Lost Boys. Well, it was four boys, and they were there with their parents, and the boys were going to go and do a trek that should have taken about 1 hour, and one of the fathers had gone with them, and he said, I'll meet you at the end of the trek, you know, I don't really want to do it, but I'll meet you at the end and then I'll take you for lunch. Well, they set off, and when they didn't get to where the father was at the end of the trek, he got a bit worried, and then another hour passed and he thought, okay, I need to get some searches or phone the police or something. So he got people to try and find the boys, and there was no sign of them at all. And then an expedition went into the forest, and eventually they had to rappel down some slopes, and they found the boys. But the boys all independently said that they had been drawn to this really enchanting music. So they'd followed, and as they'd followed towards the music, the terrain had changed. So it has just looked completely different. Well, not only that, but the scout trek, the troop that had gone in to find them, they could only get to them by going down this ravine and over to another side, and there was nowhere that you could walk around it. So nobody could really understand how the boys had ended up over there, and also it had had a landslide, so really it was just a very, very muddy and treacherous way to have gone. even if they could have gone down the ravine. But the investigator, the doctor, he said, well, there may be more to this story, because he said a helicopter was going over trying to find the boys, and the helicopter spotted a tiger, and the tiger was approaching on the path that the boys would have been on had they stayed on their path. So he said, well, with all these stories about the spirits in the woods, you know, maybe this is a case where they actually intervened and somehow they managed to get the boys off of that path, because the tiger would probably have killed them. Which is very strange.
Yeah, and I mean, it's so reminiscent of just like the fairy faith in general, with the music.
Exactly.
and
yeah. Yeah.
And these are all from, were these all from Malaysia?
All from Malaysia. And I know they have, you know, quite strong beliefs in paranormal as well. But I mean, for example, that guy, the doctor, you know, he's quite highly qualified. So, and, you know, the chief of police speaking out as well about it. So you think, you know, yes, they're all within the last year as well. So, yeah, but they are very reminiscent of the fairy lore.
Yeah, almost to a T. It's just a different different version. I mean, the jinn kind of are as well.
Yeah.
You know, so when you look at all this stuff, there seems to be something that is a constant across cultures going back in time. I mean, we don't normally look at it as the fairy faith now. We look at it more probably as the UFO phenomena.
Yeah, and I don't think I described it before, actually, but... a man called Matt DeMille contacted me a few months ago, and he described to me his own disappearance when he was a child, and he was in a schoolyard at the time, and he said, you know, I've got documentation, I've got witnesses, it happened to me, there's no doubt about it, and it was a May day when I disappeared, and when I came back, I was borderline hypothermic. He said, you know, but it was May, it wasn't cold. Well, he went on to describe what he thinks happened, and he said, you know, for years I've been ridiculed, I've, you know, pretty much suffered from trying to hold out when I've told anybody, and they say to me, well, you know, it was an alien abduction, and I've held out because it wasn't. He said, and yet you could say it sounded like a fairy abduction, and it was like I was taken to another dimension. And yet, he said, I wasn't in a different dimension, but it was as though a veil opened up and I was in between two worlds. And he said, when I saw what was in front of me, it was like I could see everything. Now, I can't describe what it was he saw, but he has never sort of deviated from that opinion. But he believes that from the research he's done over the years, that he was part of a Montauk project. Now, whether that went on or not, you know, in Long Island, it is hard to know, because I don't know anything about it personally. But he seems to have come back to this dimension with some really strange abilities. He went to the film school in Los Angeles, and he's quite a genius, really. He's developed video games and movies and things, and he sort of comes up with ideas and concepts that you then see coming out years afterwards. So it's almost as though some kind of ability to predict or you know, come synchronistically come up with things prior to them coming out. He also had something that kind of affected him from the experience, in that because he contacted me initially because I'd written about this place called Asinet Ledge, where people were reported to have had this feeling that came over them where they just felt doom and they wanted to end their lives, mm-hmm. you know, in a forest. And he'd written to me about that because he wanted to know more about it. And that's when he told me about his own experience. And he said, you know, I went to forest myself, and I've had this really terrible sensation that I've wanted to do things to myself. You know, regardless, he's kind of suffered for having stuck to this story. But so his point really has been that what he believes he went through felt very much as though it would have been classified as a fairy abduction, so taken to some kind of other world. Mm-hmm. But he believes that it was technologically done to him, so almost as though this is being manufactured, you know?
Yeah.
So it was a manufactured reality made to emulate a different dimension or the fairy portals. So that's how he believes it was done to him, with the Montauk and the, you know, he said about wanting to have certain blood types or blood lines and using some particular boys because it was easier to tune their DNA to frequencies. And, you know, and then you get into the realm of stargates and things, and it kind of goes over my head. But it was very interesting. And in fact, it was only when I was reading through his account again the other day that it kind of clicked what he actually meant. And that was what he was saying. And I didn't really get it at first, but that was what he was saying. I should have come back saying, yes, I was taken to a Celtic other world, but it wasn't that. But it was very esoteric what happened as well, if that makes sense.
Well, it makes sense to me. That's fascinating.
I mean, whether that's possible to be done, he's a very, very sincere person. Everything he says to me seems to check out. And I know that it sounds a bit strange, but, you know, it's probably possible that it could be done.
We don't have any idea what, you know, various government agencies may actually be capable of. Our technology advances at such a rapid rate that, you know, the black projects, the stuff we don't know about, has to be decades ahead of us at this point.
Well, it must be, mustn't it, by now?
And I mean, and it may have been gone. You know, you have the whole breakaway civilization idea that these groups are so far ahead of us that they're literally forming almost a different civilization.
Yeah, I mean, it does make you wonder what they were taking them into that fabricated sort of dimension for. What's the purpose for it? You know, but yeah, I don't know. It's fascinating. I'd like to know a lot more about that. And as I say, it didn't really click at first what he was saying, and then I realized what he meant, because I couldn't work it out. I thought, what do you mean it wasn't like a fairy world, but it looked like a fairy world, but it was done through this, I mean, he calls it Tesla-based technology, so you know, the manipulation, I guess, of frequency density, all of that kind of thing, in order to warp.
How does he know it was technological?
Well, because he's done a lot of research, and he believes that he was one of those boys that was taken to be experimented on. So that's what he thinks was being done to him. So that was the reason.
I would think even if he was experimented on, it may have opened something up in him that allowed him to access these other dimensions, perhaps.
It's possible. Either way, yeah. It's possible. And what's interesting, I suppose, is that it's almost like he came back with these abilities that have made him ahead of us all.
In some ways.
Because he pointed out things in films, and he's sort of shown me the proof where he has predicted or said something that's then come out. And you could say that's coincidence, but then how many times would that happen for you to be ahead of something and then to have it? Kind of like, you know, people say about predictive programming and things. Well, I guess it's kind of like that, but it seems to be that he got something from it. Not that he wanted those experiences, but something came back with him.
And it could be he's tuned into something. I mean, when you look at the Death Star, you know, from Star Wars, and then you look at the one moon of is it Saturn? I think it's Saturn. That looks exactly like a Death Star.
Right.
It has a ridge all the way around it. It has the plate in the right place, you know, and it was probably electrical scarring that caused it. But did George Lucas have some vision of this moon that we hadn't seen when he made the Death Star? That, you know, it's a really weird coincidence. And it's something that, like, Richard Hoagland has gone out and said, well, there's a secret space program. And, you know, he put it in the movie just to show that, you know, we had this information. And
gosh, what was I going to say then? I was going to say, yes. Oh, I know what it was. He pointed out to me that, again, take it for what it is, I suppose. But he said that when he was at the Film Institute, he was given a talk by the producers of the Dark Knight film, Batman. Mm-hmm. And it was still in cinemas at the time. And I wish I had the book with me. But he was told something by the production, the production of the scenery, that person was a descendant of Aleister Crowley, like a great nephew. Mm-hmm. And he was told by him about the Connecticut shooting, the Newtown, the Sandy Hook.
Right.
So he said that when the Batman was still in the cinemas, they were given a private viewing, and he also had this conversation about the Sandy Hook thing going to take place 4 years prior to it taking place. So things like that as well.
There was definitely some weird stuff in that Batman film that related to various events. And I don't remember all the conspiracy theories at this point, but whether or not they were legitimate conspiracies or not, there was definitely something weird to get all that stuff put into the Batman film unconsciously or consciously, however it was done.
Yeah.
It was definitely
hard to know.
Yeah, it's definite weirdness. I mean, we don't know how any, you know, there's too much we don't know. All we can do is speculate.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
But
I do find his take very interesting now that it's kind of sunk in.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Mm. Let's talk about the Lost Girls. This was a pretty unpleasant story.
Yeah, this was back in April 2014, and it took place in Altos Romeros, which is it's near Panama. And there'd been this massive search going on in the rainforest there because two girls had gone missing, and the searchers had had no ability to find them at all for days, and they'd sort of given up really, and the two girls had left no markers that would help them, you know, on trees or rocks. So they knew that they'd set out on April the 1st to go on this hike, and really it should have taken maybe about 3 or 4 hours, and they should have come back to the hostel that they were staying at, but they didn't return. Well, if you fast forward 74 days later, then they're found, obviously no longer alive, and they're found in a place that's 12 hours away by foot, which would be possible. But the thing was, in order to get to that place, they would have to have gone through three rivers that are snake infested, as well as down, I think it was five ravines, so down and up five of them. And it was very rainy at the time as well, so they didn't have climbing equipment. I mean, they wouldn't go over three ravines and rivers like that. It just wasn't possible. They were found by a couple who lived in the area, and the way that the couple were in the jungle was because they'd entered it from a very different direction. So it is accessible from a few miles away, that, you know, you can get into the jungle, but you couldn't get to it from where they'd gone to. When the couple were in the jungle, they found a backpack, and they opened it, and they found the passports and $80, sunglasses, cell phones, camera, and it was all very neatly packed inside. Well, they also then the passport photos they recognized from the missing persons posters that had been up. But they had a look around, and they then found a boot with part of a foot in it. And they then found a few bones. But the strange thing was that the backpack was in really good condition. So even though it had been in the open for 2 months and rain had come down on it, it was as if it was brand new. And so it didn't make sense that they could have gone down ravines and across rivers with that backpack or their clothes. So the boot was there, and the human foot inside. And so obviously the couple went off to get the police, and the prosecutor came back with the police to go into the jungle, and they were looking for the human remains. Well, they found a pair of shorts lying on a rock, and beside the backpack. But the shorts were laid out on the rock very neatly, and with even the buttons done up. And then they looked at the human bones, but they found it weird because one set of some of the bones had some tissue still on it, whereas the other bones didn't have any at all. It's been hard in a way to get really accurate information because the stories have been translated from Spanish into Dutch into English. So some accounts say that the bones were scattered over 2 miles, and some say that they were just in that location. Well, anyway, so the prosecution did say at the time that it was a bit strange that they would have a foot broken off of a body, because although it happens a lot in water, it doesn't happen so much on dry land. And another really strange thing was that one of the girl's bones had phosphorus bleaching on it. Well, this can happen if you're in a volcanic area, but that wasn't volcanic there. And phosphorus is smells strongly of sulfur because it's got a lot of sulfur in it. And the thing is, of course, how did one of the sets of bones have this on it and not the other one? So they didn't really know. Well, the two girls were Lisanne Froon, who's 21, and Chris Kremers, who was 21 as well, and they'd come from Holland. They were described as very sensible girls, you know, not really prone to taking sort of risks, and a lot of people had sort of seen them around, and they were believed to have set off on a short little hike up to a lookout point and then come back. And there was a few different accounts. You know, some people said that they didn't think they went out on the hike. Some people saw them in town in a taxi or going into town. However, they did take pictures as they set off on the hike that they didn't come back from. And so they could put the time of the picture as being in early afternoon. So it was determined that they had gone into the forest. But the baffling thing is that actually a few days after that, there was a series of about 80 photos that were taken. And this was almost, well, it was more than a week after they disappeared. So they should have been back that day. But for some reason, they had taken all of these photos. Nearly all of them are blank, but there are a couple. And one of them is with the forest vegetation in the background, but it seems to show a piece of red ribbon, or possibly it's tears of a red bag and wrappers from a chewing gum packet. There's no real sort of explanation as to what that picture was taken for, whether it meant something, you know, whether there was some kind of message in it, or whether it was just an accidental shot. All the blank pictures, you could say, well, maybe they went off accidentally, you know, while it was inside the backpack, but it was an automatic shutter. It didn't have a lens cap, so that couldn't have really happened. Then, you know, maybe they were taking the pictures because they were using the flash to try and help them see their path in front of them. But then if you do that in the dark, it can quite often cause your eyesight to go worse if you do that. So they probably wouldn't have continued doing that. Well, there was also the fact that about 2.5 hours into the actual hike, they started to make phone calls to the Dutch police. But of course, because of where they were, the calls wouldn't connect. But they continued to make these phone calls. So it's not really known why they were doing that. So it's very mysterious because nobody could really work out how they got to where they did and why they were taking the phone calls. You could say, well, perhaps they were abducted and perhaps they were taken somewhere and that's when they were using the phone, or that's when they were taking the photos to try and leave a trail or to try and signal where they were. But the thing is that the photographs do show that they were in a forest. So if it wasn't in that forest, it was in a forest. So it makes sense, I guess, that it was there. They were there all the time. But after a few of the phone calls, after a few days, the phone that was there making the calls, when it was used again, they were never able, whoever was using it was never able to put the password in again. So either the girls were by this stage very dehydrated, very unwell, and they couldn't remember the password, or did somebody have their phone, or we don't know. So the coroner said, well, there was no sign of trauma to the bones that we found. There was no signs of any injury at all having taken place, no sign of animal or human attack, no bite marks, no knife marks, no dissection marks, and also no blood at the scene. The cause of the phosphorus has also never been determined. So You could have said, well, it was an abductor who tried to destroy the evidence by bleaching the bones to, you know, destroy the corpse. But it doesn't appear that they were out of the forest. So I don't know. I mean, I suppose I thought, well, sulfur is quite a common smell that you get when there's an alien thing going on, mm-hmm. or even when there's a demonic intervention.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the most extreme scenario. But otherwise, I don't know. That I thought at first someone was trying to destroy the evidence, but there's no injury to the bodies either. So, well, the prosecutor would eventually rule that the girls had fallen into the river and been dragged away, or that they'd been attacked by a wild animal. Now, there were pumas, snakes, panthers in the forest, but the families just weren't impressed with that at all. And their lawyer said, how could they have died of an animal attack or a fall when there were no injuries, no markings or bruising, no nothing, no drag marks, and where was the blood? So they also said that the river wasn't that fast flowing at the time of year, and besides which, where their bodies were found was upstream. So they couldn't have been dragged upstream. They couldn't really understand also why, if the prosecutor was saying, well, they obviously fell in and they were dragged in the water, why their clothes were completely intact and why the backpack was clean and undamaged and why the shorts were laid out. So it's a mysterious one, because they couldn't have been dragged upstream, they weren't killed by predators, and nobody knows how they got to where they did, and their skulls were missing.
Yeah.
So I think, well, maybe somebody came in the other entrance, or no, because that wouldn't work. So somehow were they abducted, taken away, held somewhere, then driven around to the other side and put in? But then why was one body more destroyed or decayed than the other one? Where were their skulls? Why were there no marks on them?
It's just one big puzzle.
It is. It could have a perfectly mundane explanation, and it, you know, it could be that they simply were walking, they were lost, and so they tried to call for help, and they couldn't get help, they couldn't get out, and they simply died of dehydration, and that was it. That could have been what happened. Hence which they wouldn't have marks on them. You know, they wouldn't have been injured, and so that it could have been that, but it still doesn't really explain how they got through those rivers and over the ravines.
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah, I don't know.
It's definitely a disturbing story.
Mm.
Obviously, we don't have all the pieces. There's something we're not seeing there that happened to these girls, but...
Yeah, and the prosecutor, who wasn't prosecuting, obviously, but you know, is responsible for investigating the case, they stuck to the fact. Their official conclusion was they fell in, they were dragged upstream, and they were attacked by an animal. That's what the actual official document says. So it all happened.
Well, you know how how streams tend to drag people upstream all the time.
Especially when a puma is pulling you upstream.
Right, right.
Yes.
Well, I think that's what happens, too, when they get cases like this, is they just don't know. They look at the facts, and they don't add up, and they just, all right, well, that sounds good. Let's make it go away.
Yeah. I mean, it's sad for the families, because they just won't accept it, you know?
Right. Well, of course not. Now, I'm interested in what Joshua Cutchin might have to say about the sulfur smell.
What do you think he would say?
Well, I don't know. That's what his new book is about. Oh. Smells.
Oh, is it?
Yes, and he says that sulfur is the most common smell in all paranormal events. If I'm not mistaken.
It is. It is for hauntings, for any type of parent, for hauntings, for demonic.
Yep.
It always is, which is why, you know, you think, or was it an alien type thing, or was it an elemental type? Yeah, exactly. Oh, that would be interesting. Is it out yet?
It is coming out very, very soon. It's done, but it's still going through the final touches.
Oh, wow. That would be fantastic. That would be very interesting.
So I'll have to ask him, or when he listens to this, I'm sure he'll comment down and tell us what's up.
I'd love to know. Yeah.
So I think the next story we had marked down was it was one that went pretty viral. It was about this guy who was looking for an M-shaped cave.
Yeah, because I'd put it on my Facebook because I thought this is really strange. And Somebody had contacted me saying that they'd worked out the coordinates for the cave. Well, I'm sure that most people probably know of it, but a 47-year-old man, he was an amateur explorer, and actually he comes across as a really lovely guy. His name was Kenny Veach, and he was always going out hiking. Well, he went out into the Sheep Mountain area of the Nevada desert, and he said that he found this really strange cave, and he said that it was shaped like a big M, and that as he approached it, it gave him a really, really strange sensation, almost like it was very magnetic and it was vibrating through him. And it gave him quite a fright, really. And he said that he'd gone there, but he didn't have a gun with him at the time. And he felt that there was no way that he was going to go any closer without going back with a gun. Although, of course, what a gun would do against a cave, I don't know. But he felt almost as though, I suppose, something was inside the cave, you know. So he had posted this on YouTube, and, well, when people saw it, they were quite intrigued by this, and they were kind of goading him to, you know, to go back and to investigate. Some people were saying, oh, you're just making it up. That's stupid. Of course you didn't see it. And, you know, and so that kind of, I think, encouraged him. And other people were saying, whatever you do, don't go back, you know. And anyway, so he was saying, well, look, you know, I can fight rattlesnakes. I can deal with it, you know. So he said, I'm going to go back. So he went back one time, and he filmed himself, and he put it onto YouTube. But he wasn't successful in finding it again, so he was determined to go back again. And the problem was that this time we don't know if he found it, but yeah. He never came back. I was about to say, why don't we have that footage? Because he didn't come back. Sometimes I'm so stupid.
Didn't come back, and we didn't find anything of him.
That's it. So, and I thought, okay, because a lot of people said, well, this is a hoax. Of course it was. And in fact, he actually had posted a video that I was watching today, and he had put his house up for sale. And in the video, he said, this is an unusual offer, but I'm selling myself with the house. So I watched it, and he was actually just saying, I'm willing to act as a caretaker. So there was some suggestion that he was in financial trouble and he needed to begin again, and he needed to get himself back on his feet again. There was also possibly the suggestion that he had mental problems. He doesn't come across like that. He looks like a lovely person, but his girlfriend actually has posted quite a bit on YouTube, and she was saying that she's convinced he killed himself because his father had done so. Well, the thing was, of course, the interest about it was heightened because it was very close to Nellis Air Force Base. So, you know, a mystery cave and a mystery base, and you think, well, is there something, you know, more secretive going on here that we don't know about? And I think that's why people really wanted to sort of follow it. So there really are records of him having been looked for. So it genuinely was a search. So it didn't seem to be some kind of hoax. And the investigators that were looking for him, they found his cell phone beside a mine shaft. So you could say, well, he killed himself, sadly, and he went in the shaft. But they searched it and there was no trace of him. So I don't think that animals could have got to him. Maybe they could. I don't think they could have got to him down there, but I could be wrong. Well, it was a genuine disappearance, it seems, anyway. And of course, nobody has been able to find the cave. Although, interestingly, I saw, again, I was just checking up on the case today, and I saw that two boys had gone out trying to look for it. I'm not sure how far they got because I stopped watching. But I did see another person had said that they were going to go out and do this expedition, and they were going to keep everybody up to date with it. This was a few months ago, and they were going to post it all on Twitter. Then his account just had nothing else. He'd set off, but nothing else was reported after he'd gone. So I don't know if he's disappeared or whether that was, I don't know. And so, you know, it's one of those ones you think, well, what really happened and what was in that cave and why would he feel scared? Because, you know, he hiked for all his life. What was in there? Well, a man called John Yazzie, who was a former Marine and also a ranger, and a forestry technician, so he spent all of his life in the outdoors. And he said, well, you wanted to know where that cave was. So he sent me a list of coordinates, and I mean, I haven't gone out to look for it because I'm in London, but so maybe, I think he's pretty clever, this guy. So he thinks he's worked it out. So maybe somebody could go, but, you know, not disappear. But he added something to it in a way, because he comes from a Native American background and tradition. So he was describing to me how there can be, according to their beliefs and experiences as well, some kind of ability to create temporary portals that can be hidden. So these caves could exist, and the people who are part of the sort of skinwalker tradition in the secret society that they work in, they can have the ability to sort of mask a cave, and they can unveil it as they go towards it in order to go inside and perform the ceremonies. And he gave a couple of examples. He said that my aunt lives in the northwest corner of the Navajo Indian Reservation in the Coconino County. And she had been telling him about this place that you can go to, and it's in the cliffside, so you'll never see it. But if you were to go there and you're part of this little sort of group that performs the ceremonies, you'll be able to open it. But when you come back out from it, it will just go back to how it was. So, you know, is this the power of illusion and the ability to mask it with some kind of magical ritual? Or not, I don't know. And he told me quite a bit about, he was very informative actually about the skinwalker tradition and the sorts of things that they do, which is quite rare, because actually, I mean, I've got a book that comes from 1920s, I believe, that I still haven't read, but it's really hard to get information about the skinwalkers because, of course, they don't talk about it much.
Yeah.
But he also told me something really interesting, and he wanted to keep their names out of it because it had quite a sad ending. But he was working with geographical scientists, and they were out doing a survey, and this sounds incredible, but they were employed by the government actually, and they were walking past this cave-like place, and they encountered what they would call a troll. So if you think about, you know, the Norwegian sort of trolls, what mm-hmm. they look like, it looked like that. Well, he said that they made a fatal error because they insulted it. So it was about 3 feet tall, and it was thick and had really hairy, muscular legs, but they were really bowed. And it was in the middle of the day, so they, you know, they were sure of what they were seeing. But they said, what the hell is that? Mutant, that's what they said. Well, one of them had been really quite ill in the past, and literally that afternoon they started to feel really ill, and they went to the doctor, and it seemed to be that a very bad disease had come back. So it had been in remission for years, and suddenly it almost like came back within moments. That's you know what he said. I don't know, but you know.
Yeah. Yeah, there's not a ton, there's a lot of speculation about skinwalkers and stuff out there. And of course tied in with the whole Dogman legend and all that type of stuff.
But again, I was reading his account, and I read it really carefully, and what he was describing, about how they do their rituals, and, you know, they go to the graveyards and they get the bones and they mix it all up and all of the necromancy and everything. But he also explained that the crushed up plants there's a sacred datura, I think it was called. Well, one of them, if you put it in, if you break it all down, it creates this dust, but the dust is fungal. So actually, apart from the fact, taking aside all the magical ritual and that, if you take that aside, and if you had that blown into you and it went into your lungs, that may not come out. So that could actually be a way of killing somebody slowly by a fungal, because, you know, if you live in a house that has fungal or, you know, moss and damp, that can get into your lungs and it can eventually kill you.
Right.
So actually, there could be a very urbane reason for how they could do this without all the ceremony and the magic. Not saying that they don't do that, but I didn't realise that actually, yes, of course, if you put, some fungus into somebody's lungs, that's going to very difficult to get out if they don't know it's there.
True, true.
Mm-hmm.
And that could be a. You could also, you know, stick hallucinogens and stuff like that.
Well, this plant, I believe it was Sacred Datura, is highly alkaloid. And actually, if you don't handle it properly, you'll end up killing yourself with it because it's so highly toxic. Mm. But he was telling me, because he was also talking about the case of the boys that are being found dead in the rivers and how they could have been overcome. And he was saying that you can make from, I suppose, Native American natural plants, you can make that kind of strength of something that you can give to somebody without them realizing, that will totally knock them out. So that's a way that you could overcome someone and overpower them.
Yeah, kind of like a different version of a roofie.
Yeah, 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 just a natural way, yeah.
And I know there were cases, too, of people being assaulted on the street where someone would blow powder in their face.
Yeah, I read that in our English papers over here. It was in the papers last year, I think, and scopolamine, isn't it?
Yes, yes.
And you can literally blow it in somebody's face, march them. Well, you don't have to march them. You just say, would you like to take me to your bank and take all your money out? Mm-hmm. And they can give it to you, and they have no memory of it.
Wow. There's actually a movie called Upstream Color. And I hesitate to recommend it because it's a very weird experimental movie. But that's kind of what's behind that, too, where they... where a girl is kind of drugged and forced to just do whatever this guy wants, including emptying out her bank account and all kinds of other stuff, and doesn't remember what happened to her.
Oh, my goodness.
However, the movie is shot in such an experimental and weird way, it's a little hard to follow. So unless you're into experimental movies, I wouldn't recommend it whatsoever. It's by the same guy who made Primer, which is one of the best time travel movies, in my opinion.
I've seen Looper.
Looper's good.
Looper, yeah.
Primer was a very low-budget movie, but the concepts behind it were absolutely fantastic, and it's one of those, it's a little bit of a sleeper. You get to the end, and suddenly you go, wait, what just happened?
Oh, no, I haven't seen it. I have to watch that.
But, in this M-shaped cave, I mean, on the face of it, I can understand why people would be saying, you know, he was full of it.
Mm.
It sounds like a fake story. But that doesn't mean it is. Because sometimes, you know, I mean, we don't know what's out there.
Well, the only thing is, of course, that, yes, it could definitely be fake. But then they were genuinely searching for him, but it still could be fake. But his girlfriend was posting comments less than a month ago, still saying, you know, I miss him and all of this. So you kind of think if it was a hoax, they'd have got a bit bored, you know, by doing. They wouldn't still be writing, you know.
Well,
I don't know.
It's
or
also,
maybe.
It's also possible that he was lying about the cave, but then he genuinely got lost just out there hiking, you know.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, of course.
I mean,
I didn't think of that.
It's so hard to tell. I mean, he had nothing to back it up. I mean, he didn't necessarily have a reason to lie, but some people just like to tell stories. So it's...
Yeah.
It's one of those things where it doesn't sound like anything I've ever heard of before, I think is what it is. And that's why it comes off feeling a little bit like, well, he could have just made this up.
I find it hard to envisage what it looked like as well because of the M. It doesn't make sense to me that it's an M shape. But,
How would you walk into that, you know?
I don't know. I suppose the middle bit doesn't go down very... far, but it's a very unusual shape, of course, isn't it? I do not.
And at the same time, I don't want to throw it out because we don't know.
No, we don't know. I mean, he does appear to be missing.
Yeah, and he very well may be missing.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I would assume he's probably genuinely missing. I mean, that seems genuine, but you know, whether or not he actually found this cave, we may never know.
Yeah. Sad, because he looks like a really nice guy, you know, when he's talking, he's really, it's quite sweet, but just don't know.
But, and that one was interesting because it did go viral. I mean, it was all over the internet for a while, kind of like the Aliza Lamb case.
Yeah. Somebody sent me something, actually. I've got to go through that because they found a connection to another case. I've had two cases this week where people have sent me things that tie into other things I'm looking into that are staring me right in the face that I couldn't see.
Huh.
Yeah.
Is that
and one of them's...
Go on.
One of them's the Elisa Lam, and the other one is a potential connection to the cases where all the young people in Wales had gone into the woods and hung themselves, about 85 of them. And there may be a really a connection into something else I'm looking into that I would never have put together, but actually make complete sense. Yeah.
There is actually a YouTube channel, and I'm looking to see what it is. I think it's called Green Dorks, oddly enough. But he does all kinds of stuff, and one of the things he did do is take apart the Elisa Lam case piece by piece and had some pretty interesting conclusions from it.
What was his conclusion? Do you know? Do you remember?
Well, it wasn't so much a conclusion as much as he was able to sort out the fact from the fiction. And he even went to, I think, the court hearing that they had about the case.
Yeah, I think I haven't kept up to date on it, but I do think that probably in a way, maybe the consensus is that the possibility of medication may have played a strong role. Is that?
Yeah, that was definitely a possible part of it. I can't find it, but I'm pretty sure it's Green Dorks with an X.
Right.
I don't know why it's not coming up here on my email, because I had a subscription to his page. And I was trying to get him to come on and actually talk about the Elisa Lam case, but we never got anywhere with that, unfortunately.
Right.
Because he did do a lot of good work on that case and a few other missing people's cases and just other mysteries. He definitely leans on the more skeptical side, but because of that, he's kind of like tearing away the fat from it, you know?
Yeah, but that's quite good, actually, to have someone doing that. Yeah.
Yeah. So if people are interested,
it's good to have those angles.
In the Elisa Lam case, they should check out his channel. Like I said, it's Green. I think it's Green Dorks with an X, so D-O-R-X.
Right.
So. All right. Why don't we end part one right there?
Oh, okay.
And tell people where they can get your books.
Well, they're on Amazon, and I write. Although I'm Steph, I made the mistake of writing my first book on time travelers as a man because I didn't think people would take me seriously. So I write as Stephen, so S-T-E-P-H-E-N, Young, so on Amazon.
All right. And you have no website or anything like that?
No.
All right.
I've got Facebook, Steph Young, Facebook.
And and if people want to get a hold of you, what's the best way of doing that?
Email, probably, Stephen Young. author@hotmail.com or Steph Young Author Facebook.
All right. Awesome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on.
All right. And that concludes part one of my talk with Steph Young. Part two is next week. As I said, if you're a patron, you'll get part two right away, as well as an extra bit in a little while. Fairly lengthy extra bit, actually. And if you want to become a patron, go to wheredidtheroadgo.com. It's only $3 a month. It helps us out greatly, and I thank everyone who's become a new patron recently. It means a lot. Thank you. Now, to take you out tonight, I'm starting to incorporate some more music that is not necessarily relevant to what we're talking about, because I don't want to keep using the same songs every week. At the same time, I will only use songs I have direct permission from the artist to use. And so if I find something interesting, I have to get permission and put it on here. I'm not just going to play whatever. So, if you are a musician and you would like us to consider using one of your songs to end the show at some point, drop us a line. contact@wheredidtheroadgo.com. You can find all means of contacting us at wheredidtheroadgo.com. And tonight's end song, I discovered actually from listening to Welcome to Night Vale. Fantastic little podcast. Very hard to describe. If you have a good sense of humor and you like Lovecraft and stuff like that, and some of the subjects we talk on this show, you'll probably be amused by it. Go check it out. This is a woman named Aliza Rickman, and this is a track called Pretty Little Head. Enjoy.
Drop it. the thrill, cut it, stick it where you got 'em. Circle rolling under, running red to the stop. Where's your mother? Fall down dead. Dirty mind, dirty mouth, pretty little head. I wish you were here, I wish you'd make my bed. Dirty mind, dirty mouth, pretty little head.
Dirty mind, dirty mouth, pretty little head.